So it's called a clock diagram, and that's why some people call modular arithmetics clock arithmetics, actually. So the idea is to work on modularity and multiplication tables. So it's not very complicated. So the idea is the following. You have a circle. You put points on the circle. So let's say here you have 5 points. It means that we work with modulo 5. And then we pick a multiplication table. So let's say 2, for instance, which means that, so if I label all the points 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, then I take any point. So let's say this one is 1. 1 times 2 is going to be 2. And therefore, I will draw a line between the point 1 and the point 2. So if I use. Okay, so here this is. So I have a line between point 1 and point 2. Then 2 times 2 is 4. So I draw a line between 2 and 4. 4 times 2 is 8, but modulo 5. So it's 3. And that's why it's connected to this one. And then 3 times 2. Modulo 5 is 1, so there is a line between 3 and 1. Okay. Oh, good. and so then so what you can do, obviously, is to increase a little bit the number of points. So I'm just gonna change the display. Okay. Okay, so then I can increase the number of points if I want. So for instance, here I have 6, 7 points. No, 8 points. So give free so you can catch up. This is a clock representation of modular arithmetics. Okay? So here I have 8 points on a circle, and I label each point with a number. Sorry?
You have 9 points.
9 points, okay. So this one is labeled as 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, until 9, okay? And then I look at the multiplication table. So here, the multiplication table is 2. So for any point, for instance, this one is 1. 1 times 2 is 2. So I draw a line between 1 and 2. Then 2 times 2 is 4. I draw a line between 4. And then I use the modularity. So for instance, 9 times 2 is going to be 18, but modulo 9 is going to give me 9 again. OK? Okay, so that's very simple. Then the funny thing is that when I increase the number of points, so if I keep increasing the number of points, I get the following. So this is exactly the same. So this is always always multiply by 2, but I've increased the number of points, and therefore I have changed the modularity. So here, I don't know, the number of points is 42, which means this is modulo 42. So this is a representation of the multiplication table of by 2. Modulo 42. And the graph here, this is a cardioid. So this is exactly a cardioid. So the cardioid, okay, I forgot, but this is like this is a special kind of cycloid. So it's like a circle, something like that. Like if you take a circle, you take a point here. And if the circle rolls on this line and you keep track of the position of this point, it gives you a cycloid. And if you have like a speech, some relation between the size of the circle, it gives you this cardioid. Okay? So this is for multiplication table of 2. If I take multiplication by 3, I get another graph. And so basically, I have like two. I don't know, bubbles. I mean, two, I don't know, two shapes. Multiplication by 4, I get 3. And you can keep going. Can I? Okay. And you can keep going, and you will get, obviously, something different. Okay. I can show you something else. I mean, this is just to have fun because it's not really interesting otherwise. But what I can do is that instead of changing the modularity with an integer, I can take 0.1, for instance, which means, okay, I think I should go back to the original size. Okay, so when I do that, when I change by 0.1, it means that it rotates. I mean, the points rotates a little bit until I have rotated of one like 1/70th of a circle, and then I get an extra point. Okay, so it's not—it's like a smooth transition. Instead of directly adding a point, it moves a little bit, and then I add a new point. So it gives me like a smooth transition between the two. Okay. And for instance, if I take a multiplication table of 45 for some reasons, and I increase the points, I get that kind of diagrams. So you can, so you have like a, so okay, that's the funny part. So it looks completely random at some point. And then here you recover the shape for the multiplication table of 4, here multiplication table of 3, 2, and then you keep going. So you have some weird shapes at some point, and you can keep going. It gets kind of chaotic again, and at some point we will recover the multiplication table of 4, 3, and so on. So soon, yeah, 9, 4, 8. Yeah, okay, here you can guess. You have multiplication table of 3 and stuff like that. But okay, so that's funny. It's not so basically, even in math, I think people didn't really do anything with that. It's just a funny representation. And there are some relations. For instance, if you take the multiplication table and the modularity to be coprimes, you get some specific. I mean, the graph has some properties, and you can extract some properties about the arithmetic. But it, okay, it's not super deep. So I was trying to, it's kind of funny. So I wanted to find like some kind of physical application to that, maybe build some kind of toy model from that. And the idea was to find a toy model where the geometry that we see would be important. So when we have this cardioid, for instance, I was thinking that it would be nice to have some kind of physical model where you could, extract the cardioid or something. So I was thinking about, so if I go back to the multiplication table of 2, I was thinking about like generalizing Ising model in some sense. Okay, so what I would like to do is build a spin chain. So I have like a mass circle with points. I can put like a qubit on each point, and that gives me a spin chain, okay? And if I, so that gives me a spin chain, but the difference is that here, instead of having an interaction between nearest neighbor, I would have an interaction between two points which are connected by a line. Okay? So the thing is, if you think about it differently, all the points are not always connected. There are some relations. Usually when those two, the modularity and multiplication table, are coprime, it means that all the points are going to be connected, all the points of the circle. So it gives me an actual chain, okay? It gives me a chain, but instead of having the chain which follows the circle, the chain is a little bit random. It goes in the middle, and stuff like that. And then what I would like to, to see, like if I compute the entanglement entropy, like the bipartite entanglement entropy of this spin chain, to see if I get, maybe some funny properties or something like that. So at the end, what it means is that instead of looking at that, I can just think about the usual Ising chain. And instead of computing the actual bipartite entanglement entropy, I would compute the entropy for random sites. But it's not completely random, because actually I would pick the sites so that they are connected according to this condition. And maybe, there would be the entropy. Maybe I could extract from the entropy the cardioid somehow, or at least I could see that would be interesting to see the difference between the multiplication table of 2 and 3. Maybe there is a relation between those or something like that. So to do that, so because the point is to use Julia, at first I think I will try to do like an exact diagonalization. So to compute the entanglement entropy, you have a density matrix that you need to diagonalize, and then you compute the actual von Neumann entropy of this density matrix. So the diagonalization obviously is a bit expensive, and the issue is that the size of the matrix grows really fast. So if you want to compute the entanglement entropy for L sites, the size of the matrix is 2 to the L times 2 to the L. So usually after 20 sites, it's going to be an issue. But I can do the exact computation at least for 20. I mean, the point would be to see with Julia, if I can, all the tricks we can use to push the exact diagonalization higher, basically. So that could give me some insight, and then depending on what I find, maybe I will try to look at something obviously more accurate. But I wanted to talk to Geoffrey about it. Because, okay, there are many ways of computing the entanglement entropy. Usually you have to diagonalize the Hamiltonian first, but you use, it relies on the fact that you have a nearest neighbor interaction, and I'm not sure yet how I can generalize those methods with like an interaction which is a little bit different.
You still have a nearest neighbor.
Sorry?
You still have a nearest neighbor action? Or only.
Not really. I mean, no, it's not nearest neighbor. It's a.
But if you have only this interaction, then it doesn't matter that you order the sites on a circle, right? Then you just have interactions. You can just renumber them, and then you have a more trivial case.
So that's the point. The thing is, if you just look at the spin chain, it's completely trivial because it's a chain. So obviously, you have a nearest neighbor interaction. The point is, when you look at the bipartite entanglement entropy, and here, the way I would compute the bipartite entanglement, I would cut this shape in half. I would look at half the half on the right,
Okay, then it
and
becomes untrivial.
add it becomes untrivial at that point. And that's the only thing I could think of where you would have, explicitly you would use this funny geometry. So maybe with some density matrix normalization group, it could be easier to compute the entanglement entropy. I mean, I have to look at it. But I don't know, this paper you have where you compute the entanglement entropy for the spin chain, or this, the canonical way of doing it with the Fermionic operators and then Bogolyubov and stuff like that. Does it rely a lot on the fact that you have a nearest neighbor interaction? Or
Not at
not
all.
at all? Okay, good.
Though it's true that the mapping from spin degrees of freedom to fermionic degrees of freedom will only be a local map
Yeah.
if you have nearest neighbor interaction. But you could start directly with free fermions. There's nothing wrong with the system of free fermions.
Okay.
So that's your system.
Yeah, okay.
Then you can then analyze at the cost, which is the third power of the size of the
Yeah,
fermion.
yeah, yeah. Yeah, because the point of doing this diagonalization, that at the end the metric, instead of being 2 to the L times 2 to the L, is 2 times L times 2 times L. So it's a lot smaller, and you can do 150 sites or something like that. And get something accurate, obviously.
Is there any physical motivation for using this kind of interaction?
No, I don't think there is any.
Not okay.
Just, I don't know, I've looked at those shapes since
But
for a while,
are
so.
you looking for motivation to do something concrete? And you know what you want to do? I mean, it seems that you want to analyze large spin chains.
I mean, the point was to find a project where you would need to do something numerical and
Right. So with the same type of calculation that you want to do here, I can give you a motivation for this project,
Okay.
which is I have to teach the Psi students.
No, I know. I thought about it. I mean,
I'm
no, you know the,
trying to teach them with Julia,
but, no,
which I
but
haven't been able to
there
do
is the winter
before.
school in January
Where is that? Oh,
for
right.
PSI students. That could be a. And I mean, you could find them. And because it's a 1 week project, so
I see.
the project like that would be
Anyway,
so what I am looking for is a class project for him. So
Yeah, I'm gonna work on
you now
it.
complete the class. From that, I'm looking for something that obviously is then in Julia, since that's the topic
Okay,
of the class,
so
and also something that is reasonably useful for research. But it doesn't have to be a paper, does it?
So there is something very concrete that relates to what you are saying, but I want to hear what Marcus has in mind. Because you are going to talk about Vito's library?
Yeah, I'm only gonna talk about like tools for dental networks.
Does it include the linear operator?
No, it does
Okay.
not include that.
So
Yeah. I was planning on mentioning it, but not talking about it.
you said, I mean, you can always go free fermions, fine. But I think the more interesting case is the one where you generalize the whole matrix, which is 2 to the n times 2 to the n. And the first thing you can do is to never build that matrix, but use sparse. It's a
Yeah,
local
exactly.
interaction.
Yeah.
So that just the biggest object you have is not the whole matrix, which is 2 to the l times 2 to the l, but just a vector, which is 2 to the l, right?
Yeah.
So automatically you can go to twice large. The system can be twice as large.
Yeah, I agree, yeah.
And then typically with, sorry, I've not been attending.
Go ahead, go ahead. No,
I'm
no,
very
no,
short what I want to say.
no. No, there's no problem at all.
Okay, so you have this 2 to the L vector. So L now can be pushed to 30, maybe. I don't know how we're going to do 2 to the L times 2L with L20, but that sounds a bit extreme. I think 16, 17.
Okay.
In any case, now what you want to do is you want to multiply that vector times the Hamiltonian many times. Right? It's a power vector, power method. Do you call this?
Yes, to find the power methods. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So if you do it like that, no problem. You just play around with Julia. You have your tensor representing the state, the vector, as a 20-index tensor, and then you go with Hamiltonian terms one by one, right? Multiplying by a Hamiltonian is the same as multiplying or by individual terms and summing over. Very good. So that's fine. That can be done with the Julia can provide you with everything you need for that.
Yeah.
There is, though, an even better way of doing this, which is LangSource or.
But then you need an explicit representation of the matrix, though.
You don't? But in any case, typically, say MATLAB or Python, there will always come, there will be a library which says, you indicate to the computer how, what's the action of this linear operator, this Hamiltonian, on a vector. Okay. Then you provide that input, and then they find directly the dominant eigenvector of a Hamiltonian. Okay. That's usually incorporated in some library, some function in a library.
A three-dimensional library for Julia, which at least claims to do that. I haven't tried it. I don't know if you tried it.
No, but I talked to the guy who wrote the library.
Yeah.
He said, Yuto was here, visited.
So this
is the guy who wrote this library.
Yeah, he is.
And he tried to implement that. And then that's for Julia 0.3, and there were some issues. And then I wrote to him saying, hey, I want to use this. Is it there? He said, oh, yes, I'm very busy right now, but it's planning to have that done.
And I think it's now compatible with 0.4. I could be wrong. But I'm not sure how complete the library is. I don't know if all the features are there or if it's still a work in progress. We can take a look at it.
This is a type of thing that is missing from Julia and that might be reasonable to do, even though Yuto is already has done it, but it's just not operative. But for some reason, we cannot use it. Right? But that would be extremely useful. Or this basic exact generalization package that allows you to go beyond exact generalization in the beyond the building the whole matrix, right? Just never build the whole matrix.
So the kind of two things you can talk about. One is project for this class. Of course, it could be reasonable, but if it's to be useful for research in the end, then it may be too difficult as a class project. Because in a class project, you typically do something which is a proof of concept or something, but make it usable with good error messages and testing or something requires more work. But since you're all here at the Parameter Institute, you can, I mean, it doesn't have to be a class project. If that is something you need, then we can work on that with, what is his name,
Yuto.
With Yuto, or if he doesn't have time, someone here can work on that. So that's entirely interesting.
Oh, I think that the time that he would spend talking to us time that you need to finish that.
Very good. Then we can talk to him to ensure that it's the forefront of his mind.
Anyway, anything that you do that can be used to teach the students later on, I mean, I'm interested in it.
Okay.
Very
good. Thank you. Want to say something more? Don't forget to put on the microphone.
Yep.
I'll actually be talking mostly about another package by the same guy.
I think it's in your password, Eric.
Aha! Yes, very good.
Yoko. Ah, for a moment there, it looks Spanish.
go to advanced. Let's see.
So I have one book. So like you all know, I work in Tensor Network, and to start using Julia, I would need to know what Julia has for me in terms of tools for tensor networks and tools for manipulating tensors. And I spent some time recently looking into this and looking into some packages. I'll go shortly through the stuff in base, but mostly this is going to be about one package that seems good for my purposes. So this is essentially just me trying to learn what's available for my purposes and then telling about the things I learned mostly yesterday. So if you want to do stuff with tensor networks in Julia, of course, the thing you'll be dealing with is arrays. And this is just a very simple reminder of you can really generate random arrays. This is a 2x2x2 tensor. You can specify types for the elements of the array, and there's functions for special type, like this is an identity matrix of 3x3, and this is full of zeros, and it's of the same type and size as A, things like these. Ask me or let's figure it out together if you don't remember how some of these basic things work, but I will not spend time explaining these because we went through these earlier. You can do arithmetic, you can do element-wise operations, you can do slicing and indexing. This is a matrix which corresponds to having the first index fixed to 1 and then 2 next indices 3. I don't know why I did it twice. And this here now is a matrix. This is another matrix. And that thing is a transpose. And this is a matrix product. So the end result should be a matrix. And it's somewhere here if I can just pass. Oh, yeah, here. This thing is a 2x2 matrix. With some awful elements.
If you want to multiply something with the transpose or something else, there's a way to do it in one operation. You don't need to first transpose.
Oh, I see.
I mean, the result is the same, but it's slightly
different. Yeah, probably. This probably creates a temporary.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Is it just the transpose or the conjugate transpose?
Oh, it's a conjugate transpose if it's complex. That's true.
What's the z^-310?
That's. Where did my matrices come from? Oh, A is a random matrix. B is initialized without, or B is an uninitialized matrix. It just has some values, so there could be anything. Yeah. So slightly more interesting, there's reshape, which takes a tensor. Say, here we have a tensor that is 10,000 × 2 × 300, and it reshapes it into a matrix that has the same elements, but a different amount of indices. So I've combined these two indices to one index of 20,000, and then there's the remaining index of 300. This is something I end up using all the time if I do tensor network stuff. And then another thing that I need all the time is transposing, or here it's called permutim, so it does a permutation of the indices. So 2, 1, 3 is just a permutation. The first index ends up being the next second index and so forth. And the important thing to keep in mind is that reshape takes no time. It's just a matter of changing metadata about what the stuff stored in memory means, whereas transposing does take time. Although, like, you could just keep track of a transpose of like how have the indices been permuted, but this is not what Julia does. Julia actually copies the data into a different order because of how striding works, if you know what striding is.
Julia has subarrays,
and
I believe these subarrays will allow these kind of permutations efficiently. Now, of course, if you use that array later,
yes,
for example, in a matrix multiplication, it may still be necessary to either actually do the permutation or use a slower matrix multiplication.
Yeah, there's a lot. Let's come back to that later because there's an interesting point related to that when I look at this library here. So that's roughly what's in base. The important things.
But what's available beyond Base? Well, I looked into what kind of libraries I could find. I also sent an email to Yuto because I happen to know him on some level. And ask him, because he's been working on tensor networks using Julia, to ask him what kind of tools he's aware of. And this is a list I came up with. There's two relevant libraries by Yuto called Tensor Operations and Tensor Toolbox. I will today be talking about Tensor Operations. Tensor Toolbox seems to have a lot more fancy stuff in it. It has a lot of network algorithms and things like that, but it's very much a work in progress. I haven't even tried it. Yuto told me that it's in a broken state at the moment. It's also probably not 0.4 compatible. But there's a lot more complex stuff in there. Tensor Operations is very simple low-level operations, but with a lot of emphasis on having them work efficiently and having them implemented well, which I like. It is at the moment only compatible with 0.3, but if you go to GitHub, you can find a version. If you look at not the master branch of the project, but another branch, there's like a development branch which is compatible with 0.4. And apparently everything else is done for 0.4 compatibility, except that there's a lot of changes and the documentation hasn't been updated. So I had to go fetch the development version of it and to do this presentation, but shortly, he said, hopefully early next week, but we all know how these things go. It's going to be ready for 0.4. There's a couple of others that seem to do the same kinds of things, one by Andy Ferries, and I don't know who the other guy is. I looked into them. They seem much more simple, and they seem more focused on just having this nice-looking Einstein's and Mason notation for tens of things, but less useful maybe for serious use than the first one, so I decided to go with this. They are like much more bare bones, although they do have some things like single-value decompositions, which Tensor Operations does not have. And then, like a different style of library is this one. Maybe we should take a look, because this is what Gifre and me were talking about. Is it Control-C on a Mac?
No, it's Apple-C. Command C,
thanks. And Command V?
Yep.
So it seems. So this is a library that does exactly what Gifre was explaining and the library Gifre was talking about.
Okay, so you can have a procedural implementation.
Yeah. So
in some cases, this is called a procedural thing, or also a matrix shell in some cases.
Okay.
Because it's like a matrix, but there's nothing in it, right?
It behaves like a matrix, but you don't store it as a matrix.
Yes, you can't look at the elements except.
Yeah. So this has algorithms. The only requirement for a linear map is that it can act on a vector by multiplication efficiently. So you could do diagonalization type things. And
look at tests. If there are test cases, they're often good examples.
Yes.
Oh, wait, there's more documentation.
There's some. Let's see.
Okay, it defines FFT as linear map. That's nice.
And this linear combinations, that composition of linear maps.
Okay, nice.
Some in place operations, multiply a vector by a matrix, probably, or like by a linear map. And that's it. I haven't looked into this package, but
let's just go up one more and then scroll down. Maybe there's a bit of documentation here.
There's quite a lot, actually. Yeah, so linear solvers, eigensolvers, these kinds of things for linear maps that are not matrices. But to be honest, I can't say anything more about this than you can find out by reading the documentation. I have not been looking into this.
Maybe
but
hold it down a bit more. I mean, once you're here anyway. Yeah, okay. No, thank you.
Yeah. There's, seems to be a lot of structure to it. Using linear maps, yes. Yeah. Left differences, using query parameters. Anyway, for Clément, for instance, you should probably check this. But what I was planning on talking about is this tensor operations, because this is what I've been getting familiar with yesterday and today. So we load it. First of all, the type it works with, then this is something I like better about this library than the couple of other candidates, is strided array, which is a type that is already in base Julia. So it's defined like this. It's a union of two types, dense array and sub array with a lot of different, what do you call them, type arguments, type.
Yeah, so that the complicated one with the tuple. That means if you have an array, and then you can either pick a single element, that's the N64, or you can take all the elements in this direction, that's the colon, or you can have a range of elements. But it's
right.
Not complicated, it's a range, it's just a range that has a beginning and an end.
So
no,
sub.
I don't know. But that,
so yeah, sub arrays.
I'm not sure about the latter one. So anyway, the way you took sub arrays earlier, this is represented by that data type.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be. The way you did it isn't represented by sub arrays.
So this is roughly, if I understand correctly, this is roughly the same thing as views in Python, for instance, except that these can.
Or if you use LayPart, you will remember that whenever you pass a matrix, you pass 3 or 4 different integers, LDA, leading dimension, array size, and so on and so on. And this is representing exactly that.
Right. But the take-home message here is that this needs to be a subarray of a dense array as well. So this is just a fancy way of saying that strided arrays are dense arrays or subarrays of dense arrays, if I understood this correctly.
It is a restriction on the memory layer. The memory layer, they don't have to be contiguous,
mm-hmm.
but there needs to be a regularity. So if you know the every indices, I, J, K, whatever you want to index, and you want to get a particular element, then you just multiply each of the indices, I, J, K, with an integer, and then you see the memory location.
Right, so it needs to be
efficient loops over these kinds of arrays. You don't need lookup tables, and the arrays can't be triangular and tracked.
Right, so you need to have what is called striding for how you index the elements.
The that I just mentioned of IJK, that's called striding.
Yes. But so it doesn't, this whole package doesn't define any own types. Well, there's one, but that's not visible for the user. All types of its own, unlike the couple of other libraries which introduced like arrays coupled with like symbols for the indices or something. This is just, this whole package operates on the type of arrays that Julia Base already deals with. Just, I wanted to check for myself and decide that I should show it as well. What's the type hierarchy for arrays in Julia? This is just a copy paste from Wikipedia, a function that prints a type tree for some type. So everything's an abstract array, and then there's a bunch of subtypes, and you could have sparse arrays, for instance, and then there's dense arrays. Dense arrays and subtype of that is an array. So anything over here can be handled. Also shared array. So I guess this is probably what you mean, that it doesn't have to be contiguous. You can have.
No. Sided array, right? Sub array. So that's
what you have. Yeah, but like. A shared array is also called a dense array, or also a subtype of dense array. So
a shared array is I don't know what it is. It's probably a living in shared memory with multiple Julia processes working on the same memory.
Oh, I see. I see. Okay. Anyway, that's just to illustrate what's the type that this package deals with. Subarrays are over here. And there's a lot of special types for symmetric, diagonal, and symmetric, and so forth. Okay, those are the types. What does tensor operations actually do? Here's the list of things that it exports. There's a macro called tensor, which I will get to at the very end. This is for Einstein summation notation. There's a scalar is just a function that extracts from an array with one element. It extracts that one element. It's not that interesting. There's tensor addition, which sounds kind of redundant because there's already the plus operation, but I'll show you what it does later. The most interesting piece is tensor contract, which takes two tensors and contracts them together. Tensor copy, which is essentially just transposes, and Kronecker products and traces. And then there's a mutating version of all of them that for which you can give an array to which the output is stored instead of it allocating it, instead of the function allocating the memory. So I'll go through these, not all of these, but most of these one by one, show how you use them, and quickly check for many of them how they perform as well, because there's some nice performance questions here. If I'm, you, some of you have dealt a lot with code like this, and this resembles, for me, this looks very familiar, and I can easily get into how these functions work and how you call them. I don't know how familiar you are, so I'm not sure if I'm going too fast or too slow, let me know. So TensorCopy is a copy function, but the point of it is that it can also do permutations of the indices when it does the copy. So here's some array. I can do permutims, or I can do TensorCopy, the array. This just gives me this argument is for me to give labels to the different indices of A. So I just call them 1, 2, 3. This is the same thing as 1, 2, 3, with also an opening bracket. And then the last one is the permutation. So this seems kind of redundant because permutims is already in base. But there's a couple of twists. There's one which is not very functional, but just kind of fun. You can use any elements that can be compared by equality as indices for the legs of the tensor, for the indices of the tensor. So these are just symbols, symbol B that represents the symbol B, has no other meaning. But I can also use strings. This is the exponent function, because the exponent function is the same thing as the exponent function, not the same thing as a tuple with a 1, and not the same thing as the string dada. It can be used as an index. Not very practical, but just to this is true all over the package. You can do this kind of stuff with it, all of the functions. Not very practical. What is more practical is that TensorCopy actually performs better than permutims, which is kind of interesting.
It's a bug in Julia.
So there was actually a discussion where Tuto was proposing that he could work on permutims and do some of the optimizations he's done for TensorCopy. So he talks about a cache-oblivious divide-and-conquer algorithm for all of the things he's implemented.
Yeah, sounds good. Yeah,
that's exactly. Yeah, and but let's run these to some old results. But so this is a 300 times 300 times 300 tensor doing the same thing using permutims and TensorCopy, and it's taken awfully long time. Oh, it's probably it has to compile all these things.
Should I get?
Yeah, I wonder why this is. Is somebody hogging up all the resources on Compute 3? Shouldn't take that long.
But well, let's move on.
Yeah, let's.
We just really knew that Jupyter's code is
yeah, so there's this is for large tensors and this is for small tensors. There's an even more impressive difference here, although I have to admit that these results, if you rerun it, they jump around. But I've done it several times, and
so
TensorCopy is faster than permutims.
25% garbage collection time, this should not be the case in linear algebra.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe because it's the first time you run it, so it was compiled in the code.
Yeah, could
so
be.
If you run it the second time, the garbage collection time should down below percent range.
This is not this is really not
yeah,
finishing.
Yeah, maybe it's frozen, but don't
I'll have to run a lot of things later, so I'll...
Yeah, now you will need to load the package again.
Yeah, but it's only that cell that I need to evaluate. Do I have a kernel already? Did it say connected?
It's probably connected.
Yep. Where was I? Over here.
It shouldn't take any time, no?
No, I just...
But can you go up? Did you actually load the package?
I think I did. And it should give
see it. No, look, it's input 108. It should be input 1.
Let's do this once more. Restarting.
Now execute it. It's ready. It's ready.
Doesn't do anything. Does this do anything? Oh, now it seems to do something. Yeah, it just
connected. No, go up. I want to see it. As long as it says in 108, it didn't do anything.
Yeah, now it's doing it. Yeah. They flashed connected to the kernel. Oh. It still doesn't seem awfully good.
No, nice. It doesn't restart automatically. That's a lie. So ignore that message. Go to restart.
I can also just go through the rest of the presentation and look at the old results I got when I was running this.
Exactly, yeah. Just make sure you don't accidentally
do that
once more, but I don't have calls.
Nope. Okay. So anyway, TensorCopy is I was surprised and impressed by this. Now it's connected to the kernel. Let me try one more now that it's connected. Seems to be doing things. But still hangs there. Okay, let's just move on. Then there's the mutating version of it. So it needs to be given something you can store the result in. So I just initialized some tensor here and then create an uninitialized tensor of the same shape. And just for the sake of performance tests, here is permutedims. Permutedims also has a mutating version of it. It's a lot faster. TensorCopy without using the mutating version, then within the same loop, allocating the memory by hand and using mutating version. So these loops are here and over here. These should be doing exactly the same thing, and they do exactly the same thing. And then the fastest of the bunch is the mutating TensorCopy, as one would expect. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, the differences are very small. And the other ones, I mean, you're allocating memory three times, so using altogether four times as much memory as the first one.
Sorry? Which one is using three times memory?
C equals similar A. That allocates a new matrix every time. Whereas if you just do TensorCopy, the next one, this one loop here, then you're reusing the same memory.
Yeah, and that's the point why I'm comparing these two.
Yes, and that means since the last one is using less memory, that alone could be the distinction for being faster.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, that the allocation takes time. If you use more memory, then you are using the cache less efficiently and so on. And that also may make a
problem. I see.
Difference.
Yeah,
so
okay.
The numbers are so similar, you have to be careful. I mean,
yeah.
I'm sure one of them is better, but
okay, that's a good point. I didn't realize that I was thinking only of the memory allocation. Okay.
Go on.
TensorAdd is not awfully interesting. What it does, it adds two tensors, but with a twist where you can do permutations on the indices at the same time. So here I'm doing some permutation. This is doing tensor add A added to B, and I'm labeling the indices of A, and this tells me which index of B should correspond to which index of A. And it's the same thing as A plus permutedims of B, but here I need the inverse permutation of that for reasons I will maybe not explain here. The convention is different. I can also call inverse permutedims. So here, the first index of A, B gets permuted in such a way that when you add them, the second index of B, labeled here by 1, is the same as the first index of A. That's the convention here. Whereas
the
here.
Copy was different?
Sorry?
The copy was different.
No, it's the same convention, but it applies in a different way when you are doing it the same tensor.
Okay, good.
Anyway, not awfully interesting, but if you need to squeeze out performance at some point, it helps a bit. This is a comparison that's just permutedims, and this is using TensorAdd. I'm guessing somebody can confirm this who is more familiar with BLAS. These are included in the package probably because BLAS has these functions, and these are just calling BLAS functions. Am I correct?
No.
No, I'm not correct.
BLAS has nothing about transposing. BLAS is only about vectors and matrices.
Oh, I see.
And there's nothing about transposing. And if you multiply, you can pass as input which of the inputs should be transposed. And
I see.
You can multiply and transpose at the same
okay.
time. But if you want to add two matrices, then
oh, yeah.
you have to transpose them manually.
Yeah, okay.
But in first with tensors, sure, transposing true. Actually becomes necessary because there are many more. I mean, it's not just either or. Transpose or not.
Yeah. Sorry, that's true. I wasn't thinking BLAS is all about matrices. There's some other stuff later on which clearly comes from BLAS, but that's not true for this. Okay. The fun part is tensor contract, which takes two tensors. I have two tensors here. These are actually matrices, so this is just in case you want to see how, like, as an introduction to how this how the function is called. You have two matrices. You take tensor contract A, label the indices 0, 1, and label the indices of B, 1, 2, and because the label for A and B is, the label 1 is here for, it's the same for these two indices, those two get summed over.
And the output?
The output is such that the indices of A come first,
you
and
can only compare them over equality, right? They're not sorted.
No, they are not sorted. Okay. I should have used some other symbols. I could be using exponential functions here again, and then it wouldn't know how to sort them. So indices of A come first, and then indices of B. But there's also, in the last case, I demonstrate this additional
optional
argument at the end, which then specifies the order of the indices at the end of the whole thing. So at the end, a permutation is performed to have them in this order.
But I mean, what's obviously missing is a way where you store a tensor, not just as a matrix, but where it remembers the indices, kind of names for the indices.
That's what a couple of the other packages do. They create these classes, which is like an array together with names for all the indices, and then you can create things like name it the same way and just call contract, and it does the contraction automatically. If you like that style of things, then a couple of other packages by Andy Ferris and the other person whose name I don't know.
Miles, for example.
Yeah, well, he hasn't written Julia, but yeah, that's true. iTensor apparently does that, although I haven't used iTensor. Okay. Tensor trace I won't talk about because it behaves exactly in an exactly as you would expect based on that. So
there's a single input only. Okay.
It takes only one tensor, and then you have to give labels to all the indices, and the ones that have the same label get traced over.
Essentially, just tensor contract.
For
a special case.
A special case. Yes, exactly.
How many inputs does tensor contract take? Can you pass 3 or 4 inputs?
No, it only takes pairwise. Only does pairwise contractions.
Okay.
That's one of the things that I could maybe implement next spring. That's not a lot of effort. Do like a thing where you can.
I don't know. First, you want to know whether actually there's a case where contracting 3 is more efficient. Oh wait, it could do it. It could figure out the order automatically.
Yeah, there's.
Well, then you want to call it tensor network where you pass all the tensors and networks.
Yeah, and the tensor toolbox package that I was talking about has some implementations of these things. But apparently it's all work in progress and not finished and so and undocumented as well. I was just reading the code, but there's no explanation of how it works. Giffer looked like he has a question.
Yeah, no, I was meant to say that this contract, generalized contract where you put, if you want to contract a tensor network which has 10 guys, where do you know the order of the contraction? So you are not going to use this a generalized function to decide the order of contraction or anything. That's writing a single line with all the contractions that have to be performed with just a single call of a function versus having to write contract 10 times, it just saves you so many bytes and so much headache. So we've always been using this S contract or
scons, yes.
S cons,
yeah.
Right? Which was just take this contract, tensor contract function, and explain how to compose it in a proper way, right? And that saved so much time, debugging time, and stuff. It made the programming these things is okay. Whereas if you still have to go and you have 10 contractions to be performed, and you have to perform them one by one, it's it's.
Why would you walk when you can ride the bicycle?
Yeah,
but without gaining any efficiency in the performance of the computer.
Oh, yes, no, I understand completely. Yes,
yeah.
It's the user interface. It's pretty much better.
Yeah. And if there had been this week a day between Wednesday and Thursday, that day I could have spent it implementing that function in Julia. I have the code in Python. I was thinking if I had time, I'd just translate Julia, what I'd be talking about. But I didn't have the time. I'll probably do it in the spring. Whatever I end up doing, if it's central networks, I'll implement that as the first.
You mean in winter?
Yes.
Thank you.
I insist that it's more spring though. Well, maybe Canada isn't.
Okay. So I'm only talking more about tensor trace because probably get an intuition for it.
Blast is faster for large arrays. No way!
Yeah. So there's an additional argument you can give tensor contract, which is which takes two different values, the symbol native and the symbol blast, such as symbols representing the thing, symbol blast. So this could be a, in some other languages, just be a string, but this is kind of a nicer way of doing the same thing. Blast is the default one. Native is a implementation in Julia, I think written by Chuzo. I was looking at the code and it got extremely metaprogramming at some point, but I think I tracked it down to where it was, well, all the magic was happening. And there was some strided loop macros and things like that. So it seems like he wrote that himself. And this just rearranges the tensor contraction into a matrix product. So does permutations and so forth. It uses way more memory because of that. Yes, this same contraction done with blast takes 15 megabytes of memory, whereas the other one takes effectively no memory. But it's much faster for large arrays, because of all the nice blast magic.
So can you explain again why it takes much more memory with blast?
Because it takes two tensors and it has to rearrange the, like it has to do permutations on those tensors,
yes,
and create temporaries,
yes,
that are in the right form for blast to take in.
But they are going to be on the order of the size of the object you're going to be.
Yes.
Oh, so the
object here is 1 million entries, which is 8 megabytes. So two tensors means 16 megabytes,
okay, so
and the additional memory seems to be.
That's just
megabytes.
The additional memory.
Oh, yes, yes. This memory is just the additional memory.
Okay.
It doesn't. In
so one uses twice as much as the other because of the copies.
Yeah, yeah. Or one, you could say that the one like wastes that much memory because it's memory you could do without. You have to put in the input and you have to have the output, but this is the memory that.
Will then you be able to take these tensors that you want and allow to mute them? I mean, can you just convert them into matrices without keeping tensors?
This tensor contract function kind of promises not to change the tensors, so it can't do that. But
yes,
if you use tensor contract exclamation mark,
right,
then that may happen.
But I think I...
You're still mega copying.
I checked for some of the functions in the library, and it explicitly says that it's not well defined what happens if the input and the output tensors that you give it are the same. So it doesn't do it in place. I can't remember whether this was for permute. Probably was for permute. Do you see what I mean? So if I do the tensor copy with an exclamation mark, which changes the, I have to give it two tensors, one which is the input and the other one is where the output is stored. If I give it twice the same, so that it should do it in place and like put it back in the same memory space, it's, the implementation is such that it's not well defined what happens.
Okay, I don't know.
Maybe.
That's fine.
Yeah, the point being currently it doesn't do that, but if it's important that functionality is saving memory, then you could implement it because it's the same algorithm, which is the memory management.
Yeah, yeah.
So
okay,
you just need to give it a different name.
So,
yeah.
So what's the native doing? The native guy is just directly making a sum loops?
We could look at the code if you want.
No. I want to understand what it is that you can do without having to make a copy. How would you go about it?
Yeah, you could do it, for instance, that.
Just by summing.
Yeah. You could just build an empty array which is going to be your output and just take the correct products of individual elements of the inputs and sum over them. A lot of loops.
Yes.
A lot of nested loops.
Aren't you producing the new object? The final, the result is going to be stored somewhere.
Yes.
No.
It's a new object called R1 and R2 here.
Yes.
Oh, but this is a small dimensional object.
Yes.
Oh,
this is a matrix, actually, in this case.
Right. So it depends on...
It's a matrix.
I do a summation of two
yes,
indices
yes.
here.
You're
yes.
left with
100 kilobytes.
B and D. B
yes,
and D are
exactly.
Okay, I see.
Worth A, this is summed over that, and this one
okay,
is summed
so
over.
You move from n to the third power to n to the second power.
In terms of memory, in terms of storage, of, yes.
The final object.
Yes. And the reason this native is available
is that for small matrices, it pays off. Well, barely. I think these results change a lot when you run it again because of all kinds of reasons. But, and I didn't actually, I was trying to implement a very naive loop just for the sake of comparison. I didn't even get it to work. It's wasting a huge amount of memory. If somebody can immediately tell me what's wrong with it, let me know. This was something I was trying to do just before the presentation and didn't get it finished, but that's not the main
it's
point.
The temp equals zero. You're allocating new memory there every time.
But that's only a single float. And I reuse the same temp.
L-type of R3, okay.
Yeah, L-type of R3.
Did you run it once or twice?
I have a loop, like there's an outermost loop over the whole
thing.
Okay,
remember, the first time you run it is going to compile it. Oh!
Oh!
Haha, no. The problem is the following. This is not in a function. This is one of the performance pitfalls in Julia. It's not a function.
I see.
And hence,
it's on the global
all
level.
The variables are global variables.
And they are
every
type any or?
Every time you access R3, it needs to check the variable. And every time you write to R3, you need to allocate memory to store the result. So if you put that
in
a function and call the function, I mean, before I equals 1 to m can stay outside the function, and then it should be much faster, and then it's actually optimized.
Okay, excellent. I could do that and run it, but my kernel isn't working. So let's not do it. Anyway, I did this with some more reasonable numbers, like large.
If you try that later on, and if I'm wrong, tell me.
I will. I was running this earlier, and I do recall that there was usually a bigger difference between these two. So using the native for small tensors may pay off, and also if you are very much memory constrained, but not for some reason time constrained, I don't know why that would happen. But anyway, that's still something worth knowing. Blast is always the default. Just in case you happen to need this kind of stuff, I think this comes probably from Blast. So the mutating version of tensor contract, for which you give the output array, has some extra stuff. You can have, you can implement an operation of the type, take the original array, multiply it by some scalar, take possibly the conjugate, complex conjugate of one of these tensors, then do the contraction, multiply it by alpha, and sum these two up, and you can do it in one call, which I think also is a one blast call. So there's
there's one blast call.
Yeah.
You have
this is what I was getting mixed up earlier.
Alpha times A times B plus beta times C, where A, B, Z are matrices, and it's all calculated, and I don't know, I think it's stored in the same place as C in the end.
Right.
But C is overwritten.
So
the native version probably.
How funny? Like something you can still index using strides?
Yeah, integers,
no,
for example.
What I mean is if you have a tensor,
like
some funny type of object, like anything that has a ring structure.
I would assume so. I haven't tried, but.
Blast obviously can't. But the native probably can.
Yeah.
Which is another reason to buy
it. Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't think of that. That's something I could also test if my kernel was working, but you know. Yeah, that's a good point. Anyway, I didn't see, there's a difference here if you don't allocate memory, but other than that, I didn't see much of a performance difference here, but nice to know that this can be done. At the very end, this package also has Einstein summation notation. I'm not a huge fan of this. It's kind of fun for some simple things, but there's issues with it. But you can do it if you want to. So here's line 4.
I've actually been looking for a package that does Einstein summation convention.
I think this
of
does
course,
it quite nice.
My use case is vectors and matrices that are really, really small, like three vectors,
right.
Three matrices or something.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I mean, you can't call blast. All the code that is generated in the end must be inline. And on the end, what pops out must be something like 10 or 20 multiplying add operations. And everything else must go away. And of course, you can't store three matrices as arrays that are allocated. It has to be stored in tuples or something. But.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a good starting point.
Yeah, maybe you could modify this a bit. At the moment, what this does is it calls the tensor contract functions, and the default for that is blast. So I can't just give this an additional argument and tell it to use the native implementation, which maybe could do close to what you want.
Ah, you said it uses the strided array.
Yeah, like at this.
Okay, yeah,
this
then
is,
I have to define my own strided array. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah, and change this.
Okay, anyway, no,
yeah.
That's nice.
I think you only have to, like, maybe give new methods for tensor contract, because at the end, this gets passed into a bunch of tensor contract and tensor trace and addition operations. So you could maybe use the same macro and just redefine, or like, give new definitions
yeah,
for
no,
new,
no,
new
there,
types.
There could be other differences as well. Obviously, in terms of performance, if you have just the free vector, then you don't need cache oblivious divide and conquer approaches or anything, right? Just a straight loop is good.
Yeah, that's true too. But just in case this is...
So all the indices are taken to be Einstein indices then?
Yes. So here, the result is going to be matrix indices AB, and all the other indices over here are summation indices, and they appear twice. There's a B over there, and there's... one of the altered indices. There's an E over here, and there's an E over there, and those indices are there somewhere. And you can do permit transposes at the same time, of course, and things like that. I found something which, to me, seems like it could be a bug or it's a strange feature. I don't know because the documentation for this version is not ready. The old version that is on GitHub, the first version you meet, does not have this stuff. Or it has this stuff implemented in different ways. So this is something new in the OpenFour version of this. The version of this package is compatible with Julia 0.4. I think this does what you would expect this to do. So it just assigns to R1 what is on the right hand side, whereas this actually does what you would expect this to do. So it adds to R1.
What? This,
yeah. I'm hoping this is a bug. Or yeah, I don't know what's exactly going on. But Once the version comes out that has the documentation, I'll check what it says and probably tell you. So, see that how this is supposed to work and raise the issue. But anyway, this tripped me up. Here's the same thing implemented with four individual calls, which
and now we know why everybody likes science. That's amazing.
Yes, exactly. That's why I did it. And the next. Part is about why I don't like the Einstein summation convention sometimes,
what?
Which is that it's not obvious what the contraction order is. So, this is what
yeah.
I wanted to look for.
Even if you have three tensors, if you choose the wrong order, then suddenly you're performing way too many operations.
Yeah, so here I have one bond dimension that is, what is this, 1,000,000? And the other one dimension is 2, and that's
okay. Yeah, no, that's a different problem. I was thinking about something else. Sometimes the contraction, I mean, you have multiple products, there are multiple factors in a product, and the contraction involves only two of these factors. Then, of course, you want to calculate that subcontraction and not the whole term.
Involves only two? So there's one flowing
yeah,
about
so
that is like a tensor product?
Okay. Where you are, for example, V1 of A times A to C plus
uh-huh.
V2 times C. Now you can have loops over A and C at the same time, or you can split out the term A to C times V2 of C and contract that over C.
And then
do the other multiplication.
Yeah,
and that
yeah,
may
yeah.
have a smaller number of operations, even if A to C have the same bond dimension.
Oh, even if A to C have the same bond dimension.
I mean, I don't know what
yeah,
that case
okay, yes,
ABC,
yes, yes, okay, I see what you
but
mean. Like, instead of doing the one loop thing, or like one
yeah,
case
yeah,
of nested
yeah.
loops. Yes, what I'm demonstrating here is that if you do first A times V2 and then multiply V1 into it, and then, or you do first V1 and A and then multiply V2 into it, so this is just a matter of like how you put the parentheses in there. The leading order cost is the same, but the next leading order cost here is different. And if I have ridiculous bond dimensions like 1,000,000 against 2, these numbers come out very different. And it's not obvious which one the Einstein summation convention is doing.
Obviously, the best one.
In this case, yes. But if I change this to be n2 and this to be n1, then it's doing the wrong one. I think it's actually doing this. Like, I think I could change the order by.
Do you think it's doing it left to right?
Yeah.
Makes sense.
I tried this briefly. If I did.
It won't run because it won't run.
It so won't run, but I'll just write the code. So this would do it in a different order.
Okay. Yeah.
But still, it can be nice if you're doing something that is not a performance question, but it's just a horrible expression. You want to get it right, and it looks neat, and it's a one-liner. And if physicists easily understand this notation. And he's also planning on one of the like maybe features in the future, things listed in the documentations was finding the right contraction order and doing this in an efficient way. Even if you...
Do you know what he does with the tensor expression? Does it get translated into loops or into tensor contract expressions?
Tensor contracts. It gets translated into
good.
These.
Yeah, very good.
And traces.
Yes.
Yeah, naturally. So that's essentially what this package provides. What I'm still missing from the things I need in my daily life is an SVD that would take a tensor, arrange the indices so that everything's on the one side and everything else is on the other side, SVD, and then arrange the indices back. Just a convenience thing so that you don't have to do the permutes every time by hand. Eigenvalue decomposition in the same way for tensors. Then network level contractions, what Gifford was talking about, having several. So this is essentially SCON.
Scones?
In plural?
I think it's scones. Is it not?
Mine is called scone, but I wrote it myself.
Sorry, no.
I wrote it myself, so it's exactly
the
what I decided it to be.
The first was from Robert.
We have been using SCON for maybe 10 years.
Before.
What does S stand for?
Sorry?
What is S for?
Super.
Uh-huh. I'm going to implement and call it HCON. For obvious reasons.
I would have gone for TCON.
Which tensor compression?
I know, because I graduated at the University of Tübingen.
What's H?
It's
hyper. Hyper.
Got a one up it.
Nice try.
And
it's
then,
symmetric tensors, okay. Is that important?
Yes, it is for my purposes.
You mean really symmetric or do you mean arbitrary symmetry?
I should specify very carefully what I mean here. One thing would be implementing tensors that have like symmetries where if you permute the indices then the tensor stays the same. I think Glenn has MATLAB code for this. I don't even have this implemented. I'm currently doing all this stuff in Python. I don't even have that. What I do have in Python and what I would certainly need is tensors that are symmetric under the action of some group. So if you take all the indices of some tensor and multiply it by the right representation of the element of some symmetric group.
That turns out is actually a highly complicated topic. And in relativity, you have that all the time. If you look at the symmetries of the Riemann tensor or the Einstein tensor, I mean, they are for indices and so on, then it's quite complicated. And finding representations for that and so on. And I know of the Mathematica package for that.
I don't think you're talking about this.
Not the symmetries.
No.
You think it's different?
I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
So the idea is that you have, you define, say you have indices which are arbitrary dimension, 3, 4, 5, whatever. And now you have, say, the group Z2, and you define how, if you think of each index as defining a vector space, you can define the action of the group Z2 on that vector space. So far, I'm not saying. Now let's define a symmetric tensor. So you have your tensor, you have the definition of how the group acts on each leg, and this is really, it's as if each leg was a side in a quantum many-body system, maybe that doesn't help here. I don't know if that brings you.
It may help, I think it does, go on.
So when you have a global internal symmetry in a many-body system, the Hilbert space is a tensor product of local Hilbert spaces.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what each index on the tensor represented. And now what you have is that the group acts as a tensor product of acting on the symmetry. By symmetry, we mean a symmetric tensor is a tensor that when you act on each index with the group, then the tensor remains, stays in value. I know, sorry.
That is different from what I have.
Yeah.
It's definitely different.
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe that's, yeah. My explanation might not have been very useful, but it convinced you that it sounds different, right?
Yes.
Are you familiar with the tensor network diagrams? Like,
yes,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So,
I think I've implemented tensor network algorithms.
Okay.
You implement TRG?
Yes, yes.
So, like, if I have a, can I move this by hand? How do these things work?
Use the wipe on the side here, that's easier.
Yeah. Sorry.
Don't fall down.
So, for instance, I may have a tensor such that when I multiply all the legs here by, let's say this represents some spin system, this could be a spin flip matrix, which squares the one. Squares one so that that's just the identity. So it's a representation of
the square root, yes.
Of the Z2 group.
Okay.
So if this is the same thing as the original tensor, then we say that this tensor is Z2 symmetric under this representation that X defines. And this shows that there's redundancy in the elements of the tensor, so we can save memory and also computation time by dividing the vector space of each leg into blocks and so forth and so forth. There's computational cost to be one if you know that there's a symmetry like this that the tensor has.
What's the implication of such a symmetry if you have a matrix to the leg tensor?
Oh. It would be block diagonal. Yeah, you would know that the matrix, if this was that, then you would know that this thing is block diagonal. And you could just.
No, in a given basis.
Yeah, in some basis.
And so the point is to work on that basis,
yeah,
and store the block instead of the whole matrix.
Yeah. Save memory and save time.
It's block diagonal, you think?
And I was thinking that implementing this could be the project I do in the winter, in Julie. Because if I want to start
that reminds me about a comment I wanted to make earlier.
Sure.
So a block diagonal matrix is, of course, an array just the matrix of matrices.
Sorry? A block diagonal matrix is just an array of matrices?
A matrix of matrices.
I would even say a vector.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's diagonal, yes. But in principle, Julia's arithmetic linear algebra is powerful enough that the entry of a matrix or of a can also be a matrix. I mean, there are probably some details due to be sorted out in the end, because
yeah,
what is a scalar, what is a matrix, how to add things and so on. But in principle, that should also work.
Yes.
So then you would have a matrix of a matrix, or a diagonal matrix of a matrix. And in principle, that should work, apart from hundreds of details that you need to,
yes,
sort out.
Yes, I did this in Python. That was a very bad idea.
In NumPy or Python?
In NumPy, but...
In NumPy, it doesn't work, because in NumPy, you need numeric data.
Oh, no, you can have NumPy arrays of objects.
Okay, cool.
It's not very fast, but you can. But it turned out, like, at some point, I just ran into the limits of what NumPy can do reasonably, and then it turned out real ugly. So I did this first in Python using as much NumPy as I could. Then I implemented the same thing in another way in Python. Maybe this would work better in Julia, where,
okay.
I mean...
So what I would do in Julia, I mean, I would try what I just said, but I'd define a new matrix type or a new kind of a block diagonal matrix where the actual entries are then the existing dense matrices or something, strided matrices, whatever they're called, but the outer shell is something that you provide.
And it's probably some type of sparse matrix implementation, like...
Well, if you know it's diagonal, it doesn't need to be sparse. Yes, could be diagonal, or could be something.
Yeah, like in the general case, when it's a tensor, the tensor consists of blocks that are
well, if the blocks can be anywhere, then you would have some sparse representation.
Yeah, that's all.
And you could maybe even use the existing sparse representation, but all the functions, you would explicitly implement wrapper functions to make sure you can handle all the special cases wrong and don't get confused.
Yeah.
Sometimes when you write array of array in Julia, Julia is so clever, say, ah, it's just an array, not an array of arrays.
Yes.
And you, that, that
yeah, NumPy gave me a lot of headache when I was doing this for exactly the same reason. I was trying to be way too clever at some point when I had arrays within arrays. But yes, do you know if the Julia sparse array in base can handle tensors or just matrices? Because NumPy sparse matrices are just matrices.
I believe they are just matrices, because when you want to have sparse tensors, they depend on two levels of representation. If you have a sparse matrix, then what you typically say, for each row, I have a sparse vector or something.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, abstractly, in a concrete case, of course, it's all matched together and so on. But of course, you don't have to say, for each row, I have a sparse vector. You could say, I have a sparse vector of sparse vectors.
Right.
And if you have tensors, then this distinction becomes even more important. And therefore, you probably have to do it yourself. And then, of course, if the column has a sparse vector or whatever, for each row, I have a sparse vector. You can also say, for each column, I have a sparse vector, and so on.
Right. Okay. I should look into that once if I start implementing this. Look at how all these things in base actually work and what which of them I can use.
Yeah, it also depends on the structure that you have in the end. So, I don't know, if you want, we can chat up and over.
Yeah, we probably should once when I'm about to start implementing this. I'll probably first in the spring do the other things like the SCON function, for instance, but that's going to be a less than a day of work. But that would be implementing these kinds of symmetry preserving tensors would be something I really need, and it's a lot of work, but it would be very useful. And I can also, I have the Python code already, so I can use that as basis.
Very good.
That's all I have to say.
Thank you for the presentation.
That took longer than I expected, but...